This Frontenas podcast is brought to you by TechPont, a San Antonio company that uses cutting-edge digital technology to elevate marketing and advertising campaigns while reporting on transparent, measurable results. Their custom-built marketing strategies offer complete digital solutions and management. TechPont strives to help businesses connect with customers and effectively grow businesses. More at TechPonte.com.
I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. This is Fronteras, a program about issues along the U.S.-Mexico border and changing demographics in the Southwest. Curanderas and curanderos are traditional healers, and they remain respected figures in Latin American culture. People from all walks of life seek their help with spiritual, personal, and physical ailments. They might sweep you with some hierbas or rub parts of your body with an egg. Chocolate, chocolate, is also uniquely Latin American. The cacao beans from which chocolate is derived is native to Mexico. The Olmecs, a pre-Hispanic civilization, were the first to use the beans in a liquid form. You have them to thank for that steaming mug of abuelita chocolate. But what happens when you put the two together and present them on stage as part of a one-woman show? You get to play Curanderas and Chocolate, Cuentos of a Latina Life. Patricia Zamora is an actress living in San Antonio. Her semi-autobiographical show celebrates her Hispanic culture and honors her life experiences. Zamora says that after giving up acting for a decade to raise her young children, she started writing again.
And I wrote my first monologue, which I call, in this show, 30s girl. It recounts my first experience visiting a curandera. I actually was sent to the curandera by my mother. She had sent me with some petitions for other family members that were struggling. She said, "You live in San Antonio." I got the name of a curandera in San Antonio because my mother was living in Premont, Texas. That's where I'm from. And I went to the curandera's house, and it was such an interesting and life-changing experience for me that I wrote about that. And it's been my go-to monologue that I've used for many different performances and occasions, and just sort of was the, I guess, impetus monologue for me to continue writing about this type of mystical experience that I had.
So curanderas, you know, people go to them for cures or to maybe to cleanse them of bad spirits. Mm-hmm. What was the reason that your mother sent you to the curandera? Was it just to deliver the petitions something separate for you?
It was. But I figured while I'm there, I was really struggling. I was in my 30s. And I was single. My mother had always told me, focus on your education. Don't rely on a man. And I did. And then I was in my 30s and I was alone. And I thought, oh, okay, well, I focused on my education and I'm not relying on a man. But, you know, I'd like some companionship. I decided to ask the curandera for help in that way. And my monologue recounts my experience from walking in to the curandera's house, to the prayers that she gave me, which were extremely powerful, and the results of those prayers, and the result of having faith. And that's really an overarching theme in this show, Curanderas and Chocolate.
So let's talk a little bit about that show. We were talking a little bit before we started rolling tape, and you said it's your very first one-woman show. That has got to be daunting.
It is. It's scary. I've already had actors have dreams. I don't know what kinds of scary dreams that radio show hosts have, but actors have. I've had the dreams many, many times where I'm on stage and I don't know what show I'm in. I don't know what my lines are, and it's my turn, and I'm just sort of making things up. Well, a few weeks ago, I had the dream where I was backstage getting ready for Curanderas and Chocolate, and my crew was back there, and things were going wrong, and I had no clothes on, and I couldn't find any clothes to wear. This is like a terrible image for some of you that know me, but you cannot unthink that. But it was like just really telling of how transformative this is going to be for me. I truly believe that when you get out of your comfort zone that you grow. And this is out of my comfort zone because I'm used to playing in ensemble casts. It's also out of my comfort zone because it's my own writing. And I've not shared a lot of my writing. I've workshopped it. And so it is daunting in that way because I am sort of exposing myself as the dream revealed. I'm exposing myself 100,000%.
But with clothes on.
With clothing. There's no nudity in the show whatsoever. None at all. Yes, with clothing. A couple of accessories and neat stuff. It's been an interesting experience because I've directed shows before. And as a director, every time we had a rehearsal or every time the show ran, I would go, oh, so that's what that means. There were always discoveries that I made. And even as a performer on stage after performance, oh, okay. So in terms of relationships, and I'm interested to find out and make discoveries about my own characters, about my own writing, and about myself by doing this.
So what's the journey you're taking us on in Curanderas en Chocolate? Is it mostly autobiographical? Are you taking us through characters that are maybe inspired by your life experience? Mm-hmm. So what kind of journey are you taking us on, and how does the theme of Curanderas en Chocolate fit into your show?
Well, an important part of the title is Curanderas en Chocolate, Cuentos of a Latina Life. And those cuentos are what is shared. And it's semi-autobiographical. And what I mean by that is that I've heard stories, or partly they've happened to me, or people that I've met along the way, or I've learned and observed people along the way. And so the show is actually 7 different characters and 9 different vignettes with an overarching theme of healing. Because I really examine the curandera, which is a faith healer. You can have faith separately, and you can have healing separately, but they really rely on each other. That's an overarching theme in the show, and these very different characters with very different cuentos examine different aspects of healing.
So how does your culture as a Hispanic woman influence the writing that you do in this particular one-woman show and other writings that you've done?
Well, I'll mention my mother a lot. If I've already mentioned my mother a lot, I'm very influenced by my mother's stories. And it's interesting because when I was pursuing a graduate degree, I was in a class, and I can't remember the name of it, but they asked us to do oral histories. My parents are not very magnanimous people. They're quiet people. There were people in my class that were saying, my grandfather fought with Pancho Villa. And I thought, oh,
I think everybody's got a story of their grandfather fighting with Pancho Villa.
I'm going to have to do some ancestry to see if I have the, 6 degrees of separation to Pancho Villa. I'm sure I can find it. But, I decided to interview my mother. And she shared a lot of those mystical stories that I had heard all of my life that I just really discounted because I had heard them over and over again. And there's one faith healer that's really prevalent in my life because I lived in Premont, Texas. And in between Premont and these two small towns, Premont and Falfurrias, is a little town called La Gloria. It's not even really a town. It's just like, it's a sign. It says, like, that's it. And there's a big tower and a couple of, you know, ranch homes. But in that country area is where a faith healer from that area named Don Pedrito Jaramillo is buried. And so we would often visit his shrine, and my mother would pray. And I just followed suit. So every time I would visit from Austin or Houston or San Antonio, wherever I was living, I would visit that shrine, and it just became embedded in my DNA to pray to Don Pedrito. And I remember my grandmother had an altar in her bedroom with candles and little monitos of saints, and this picture of Don Pedrito that she would pray to. So a lot of the show is the stories that we've heard, stories that we share, and stories that we tell ourselves. So just thinking about the concept of a cuento and those types of stories. But all through my life, hearing these mystical types of stories from my mother have fed into this creative beast that has become this show, all of these wonderful stories that she shared with me.
So you've said that this show is about faith and healing. What kind of healing have you encountered in developing this show?
I was thinking about that. And it really, sometimes it takes something very painful to push a creative, you know, into doing the work. You know, because I would write and then I'd put it on a shelf. And then I'd take it off and I'd write some more. And this went on from 2014 until today. And finally it was, I'm going to complete this. I'm going to create this show. And it really was losing my father a few years ago. When you think about death and you think about the time that we have left and the pain that you feel when you lose someone, or you know, it could be in a breakup, it could be the death of a family member, it could be a friend moving away, it could be so many different things, it could be losing a job, that pain that you feel of loss. And I chose to write, and I chose to say, okay, I'm going to share my story because our time here isn't really promised. And that's sort of what pushed me to the next level. You know, that personal pain that was the spark that really prompted me to write and share these stories and to perform, to get on the stage and share them with a larger audience than just, you know, an acting class or whichever, or just my family. So it was losing my father that was still very painful. And there are different themes that are explored in each little monologue. And one of the themes is a family estrangement. And so a lot of families go through painful estrangement issues after a parent passes for whatever reasons. And so that's something that I'm dealing with. Just being able to talk about it, just being able to sort of share that little theme is healing for me. Absolutely.
That's San Antonio-based actress Patricia Zamora. Her one-woman show, Curanderas and Chocolate, Cuentos of a Latina Life, opens next weekend at the Overtime Theater in San Antonio. For more of our interview, including a talk about her start in acting, what makes great theater, and why curanderas are a common denominator in Latin American culture, visit tpr.org. Coming up, survivors and descendants of Japanese internment camps in the U.S. speak out against family separation and detention.
We are fighting for you here, and we are fighting for you back home. And we will come back, and we will bring more people. Yes. Do not lose heart.
That's next on Fronteras. Welcome back to Fronteras. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. Families separated. Detainees living in uncertainty, wondering why they're being held, where they're being held, where their loved ones are, and when they'll be released. This isn't a scene from 2018 or 2019. This is a scene from 7 decades ago, when Japanese citizens living in the U.S. and Japanese Americans were all told to report themselves for relocation during World War II. One of those relocation camps was the Crystal City internment camp, about a 2-hour drive southwest of San Antonio. Former child survivors of the Crystal City camp see dangerous parallels between the peril facing today's asylum seekers and what their families experienced in the 1940s.
I was born in the concentration camp in Topaz, Utah, 1942. And we had a questionnaire about our loyalty, and my father answered, no, no. So we went to the segregation camp in Tule Lake, and we were there from, 1942 till 1943. And then when my father was sent away, we stayed a year then, and then we came back down to Crystal City.
That's Kiyoshi Ina, a 77-year-old former child detainee at the Crystal City Concentration Camp, as it's called by many survivors. His sister Satsuki was born in the Tule Lake Camp in California. Their parents were American citizens, but they renounced it in protest. Kazuma Kaz Naganuma's family was living in Peru during the war. Many Japanese traveled to the South American country in the late 19th and early 20th centuries for economic opportunities. During the war, the U.S. ordered the deportation of Japanese and German nationals living in Latin American countries for, quote, hemispheric security.
We were brought here by the FBI. This is, again, at gunpoint. They gave my dad 3 days to get everything. We actually got nothing because we couldn't bring it, hardly anything. They separated my dad and my oldest brother.
The family was put on a cargo ship, and after landing in New Orleans, they were put in a train with blacked-out windows that took them to Crystal City.
When we arrived at the camp, my mom thought she was in Japan because the people that greeted us were Japanese. It turned out that they were the bus drivers that took us to the Crystal City camp.
Naganuma, the youngest of seven children, was only 4 months old. A group of six Crystal City child survivors recently joined other detention camp survivors and their descendants on a pilgrimage to the former segregation facility. The South Texas camp was the largest internment facility in the U.S. and the only one built for families. Sprawling across hundreds of acres, surrounded by barbed wire fencing and guard towers, the camp also held German and Italian detainees. All that's left of the camp is a grassy field the size of a small public park, dotted by about a half dozen concrete foundations. All that's left of the cottage houses where families lived. The land is now owned by the Crystal City Independent School District and the city itself. Reverend Roland Kobata of the Buddhist Church of San Francisco led a Japanese Buddhist meditation ceremony on the concrete-covered shallow remains of the Japanese swimming pool, where many detainees came to cool off in the South Texas heat. The former Crystal City child survivors lit incense in a purification ritual. After the ceremony, camp survivors and descendants made their way by bus to nearby Dilley. The South Texas Family Residential Center in Dilley is holding upwards of 2,400 mostly Central American asylum-seeking mothers and children. The survivors and descendants of Crystal City and other segregation camps say they're seeing history repeating itself. Michael Ishii helped organize the Crystal City pilgrimage and Dilley protest. He's a descendant of concentration camp detainees.
We are partly here not only to oppose what's happening in these camps, but also for the healing of our people who were also incarcerated. So it's important for us to be here. We had to be here today.
Ishii addressed over 100 protesters who lined a stretch of Texas State Highway 85 just outside the Dilley detention facility. Thousands of colorful origami paper cranes fluttered in the March winds along the wire fencing and barbed wire that surrounds the Dilley facility. The cranes were folded, linked into chains, and mailed from all across the U.S., including San Quentin Prison.
In our culture, the crane is a creature of transformation. And we asked for 10,000 cranes because in traditional culture, the 10,000 things means more than you can count. Well, we received over 25,000 cranes.
In what was mostly a symbolic gesture,
Ishii addressed the women and children inside the detention center.
We have not forgotten you. We think of you every day. We are fighting for you here, and we are fighting for you back home. And we will come back, and we will bring more people.
Yes.
Do not lose heart.
Say it loud, say it clear. Immigrants are welcome here.
Say it loud, say it clear. Immigrants are welcome.
The protest featured chants, music in the form of traditional taiko drums, and proclamations of rage and hope. At the end of the protest, Crystal City survivor Satsuki Ina invited the crowd to sing along to the traditional children's song, Kutsuganaru, which roughly translates to Our Shoes Ring. It was a song Japanese parents sang to their children in the camps. The protesters plan to return in November. Thanks for joining us this week on Fronteras. You can find the show under the Programs tab on our website, tpr.org, and wherever you get your podcasts. Fronteras is produced by Norma Martinez and Lauren Terrazas. Our executive producer is Dan Katz, and our editor is Fernando Ortiz Jr. Charanga Cakewalk composed our theme music. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio.